Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 259, recorded Monday, August 1st, 2016. David Heinemeier Hansen. Triangulation is brought to you by Tracker. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Pair Tracker to your smartphone, attach it to any item, and find its precise location with the tap of a button. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TRIANGULATION for 30% off your entire order. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/twit. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we talk with some of the most interesting people in technology, get to really pick their brains, give you in the chat room a chance to talk to them, and you're going to be thrilled. I'm very excited to talk to David Heinemeier Hansen, the creator of Ruby on Rails, founder of what was 37 Signals, now Basecamp, and a legend in programming, and also a really great guy. David, welcome to Triangulation.
Thank you for having me.
I was looking. You had some commits on Ruby on Rails just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, just actually over the weekend here on Saturday, I was working on a new feature.
So that's impressive as hell.
It's fun. That's what it is. That's really the secret to it.
Yeah.
I mean, you do it not because you have to, because you want to.
Right. That's pretty cool. I think that's really cool.
And it's funny. It's one of those things where you go like that Saturday where I got to work on a couple of new features, which involved my favorite activity of working on Ruby on Rails, which is to look at the Basecamp source code and spot duplication and things that can be better. And then I went like, wow, I'm really annoyed with how we keep repeating this pattern all over our jobs. Let me extract that and put it into Ruby on Rails. And I just find that to be just so much fun.
Yeah.
There are really very few things I would rather do than that. And that includes driving race cars.
That's pretty exciting. All right.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that once you find a creative, intellectually stimulating activity that you really like programming, like there's, at least I've found, nothing else even that a large amount of money can buy that's more rewarding than that.
Well, I think that underscores the fact that it's an art.
Right.
You know, yes. Donald Knuth is always talking about, you know, he has the art of programming, and whether it's an art or a science, and he always said it's an art. And I think for people like you who are deep into it, it's your art. It's like painting a painting for you.
Absolutely. And yeah. I mean, it's both, right? But for me, the interesting part is more the art part than the science part. I mean, occasionally you have to do the science part, but I find that more a means to an end. And then the enjoyment of just using a beautifully expressive programming language like Ruby to come up with something new that wasn't there before, or take something that was and make it just so much more succinct and beautiful, is just so rewarding.
Do you, you came to programming relatively late. A lot of the people we talk to on this show who are programmers started as a kid. Parents gave them a Commodore C64 or something like that, and they were 8 years old. But you were an adult, weren't you, when you first started writing software?
Yeah, I mean, I had dabbled with it for a long time. I actually got my first computer when I was 6 years old, an Amstrad 646.
An Amstrad.
I never did any programming. I mean, I typed in a program for a magazine, but it wasn't because I wanted to program. It was because I wanted to play the game.
Right.
And that was really what drove it. So I never really got into programming until I was almost in my 20s. And I certainly didn't get into it as a profession until quite late. And I think that's one of the things that's opened up recently, that programming that I've found through languages like Ruby has become more art than science, that has opened it up to a wider audience that didn't start out being a science person, science geek from early age, and has attracted a lot of people who just are clear thinkers, clear communicators, and clear writers. Because the art of programming is now more about that for a lot of domains in programming, that the kind of programming we do when we write information systems is quite different than the kind of programming you write when you write an operating system or any of the really low-level stuff that was more of in decades past. I'd say, I don't have any stats to back this up, this is just shooting from the hip, but I imagine that the majority of programming written today is about information systems. It's not about core, deep-level, science-based programming. I mean, it's all based on science, but we're building on top of giants here, right? So just like lots of art, music is based on science, but you don't have to be a scientist to play the guitar really well or use an iPad to draw a beautiful picture.
It makes sense. You get the foundation done.
Yes.
I often think about, you know, because I've been covering technology since full-time since the early 90s, and I often think about the stereo gear thing. You're too young to remember this, but in the 50s and 60s, it was all about amps and tubes and total harmonic distortion, and it was about the nuts and bolts of it. Right. And then around, you know, 1966, 67, the content started to take precedence, and nobody now pays any attention to the hardware.
Exactly.
It's about the music you play with
yes.
it. And I think that's analogous to what's happened to computing, I think.
Absolutely. And I think that that's why I got into it so late, because simply speaking, programming just wasn't an activity that I was interested in prior to the internet. And prior to programming languages like Ruby that really took it up a much higher level. Because it wasn't actually because I hadn't played with programming languages. I just didn't like it.
You didn't like BASIC.
No, I didn't like BASIC. I didn't like AMOS. I didn't like Assembler. Oh. I didn't like C. I didn't like pointers. I didn't like all of the sort of science, math-based programming. That's for a long time. I felt like, well, to be a programmer, because I knew tons of programmers, right? Like I grew up with a lot of programmers. Perhaps even the majority of my friends were programmers in some form, thinking like, that's not my style. That's not what I do. And like they were programming in Assembler, and I just went, wow, that's awesome. That's impressive. And it's totally not me. It's totally not what I want to do. So I just couldn't see myself as a programmer and fit into that. So for a very long time, I thought like, yeah, that's not what I'm going to do. I mean, I love software and I want to work in software, but I don't want to be programming C or programming Assembler to do so.
So you really, it wasn't until programming went from a left brain activity to a right brain activity that it really fired your synapses. Yeah.
Yes.
And that's the art.
Even when it did that, like I sort of got starting with some commercial programming in PHP and Java, I did not think of myself as a programmer. Even though I was building whole systems by myself, I was thinking of it as a means to an end. And it truly wasn't until I discovered Ruby that I went, oh, wow. This is it. Like, this is really what programming is. Now I can consider myself a programmer because that's actually something that resonates with me on a deep identity level, that this is the kind of stuff I want to do. I want to write programs like this.
I get that, actually. I didn't become at all interested in computers because I'm a lot older than you. When they were room-sized and you had to go to the basement of the computer science building with a stack of cards. But once it was on your desktop, I did get very interested. And I had the same kind of epiphany you had with Ruby when I first read Kernighan and Ritchie, the C programming language. It was so thin and little. And for me, it did resonate. It was beautiful. So I understand. And, you know, when I first started playing with Ruby, I had that same kind of epiphany. I'd done a lot of Python and Perl. And then I tried Ruby, and it was as if everything that Python and Perl were going for crystallized. Matt's in this beautiful kind of it's orchestral. It's like a beautiful instrument. So I get what you're saying.
I think that was what was so interesting about Ruby for me is that Matt just took all these influences, right? Like he sampled from Perl, he sampled from Smalltalk, he sampled from Java, he sampled from all these interesting places, and each of the individual sources I'd go like, eh, that's not me. But then you put it together in this mosaic and you just go like, wow, this is really blowing my mind, like this mix up. Because Ruby truly, I don't know how many things it was first at. I haven't even checked. I don't think it's very much. I think the vast majority of Ruby and the vast majority of its beauty comes from remixing programming languages that already were, that already existed, and you put them together in new ways, and it just became a new thing, not just a remix.
There's also a philosophy. You know, we just had Larry Wall on. Of course, Perl's philosophy is tin stoffel, or not tin stoffel. there's more than one way to do it, whatever that acronym is.
Right.
And then
Python is exactly the opposite, right?
Yeah, right. And then, but Matt's and the Ruby community's motto is Miniswan, which is Matt's is nice, and so we are nice. I like that.
I think that slogan perhaps worked better in the
not
in the
so
early
much
days, the early 2000s when there were, I don't know, 200 people.
A
in the
few
Americas.
Of them, yeah.
Right.
All right, let's take a break. We're talking to David Heinemeier Hansen. He is, legendary. You just say DHH. There are a few initials, RMS, that you can use, DHH, Matt's, that you can use. Matt's is not an initial, but that you can use, and people go, oh, yeah. And DHH is one of them, and it's really a thrill to have David Heinemeier Hansen on our show with us today. We're going to talk a lot about Ruby on Rails and Ruby and Basecamp. Because he's also a founder. He's also an entrepreneur, and it takes the same art that he's taken and built Ruby on Rails with and applied it to the building of a company, which with Jason Fried. Jason, I've interviewed him many times. Fried?
Fried, yep.
I always want to say fried.
Right. Yeah, that's how it's spelled. Like a lot of things.
Jason Fried, and we'll talk more about that in just a second. Really thrilled to have you, David. Thank you for joining us. Our show today is brought to you by these little doohickeys. This is so cool. This is I have a couple of these here. This is my new tracker. Go to thetracker.com to learn about these. These are little tiny, quarter-sized Bluetooth LE trackers. You put these, they're so small that you put them on a keychain. It's anodized aluminum. You could put them on a remote control. They're small enough, they're like pet tags. You could put them on a pet. In fact, they have a little waterproof enclosure to make that even more easy. And look, they just sent me a Leo tracker, and I have a triangulation tracker too. I think you can order these on the tracker site. They have customized trackers. You pair it to your smartphone, attach it to any item, and then you can look at a map, the tracker app on your smartphone, and see where your stuff is. And vice versa. It's kind of two-way tracking. There's a button on the tracker. You see that on the bottom? You lose your phone. You press that, your phone screams, or whatever sound you want to put on it, even if it's silenced. So it's really cool. But now you're going to say, and I know I said this too, well, wait a minute, Bluetooth LE, that's what at most 100 feet. What happens when I get farther away from my keys than that? Let's say you leave your keys on the beach. You get in the car, you drive away, you forget that you left them on the beach. What do? Well, Tracker, look at this. This is the world's largest crowd GPS network. This Tracker's not GPS, it's just Bluetooth. But when anybody walks by your keys with the tracker attached, if they've got the tracker software on their phone, the tracker software on the phone will say, oh, hi, I see a tracker. Oh, it's Leo's tracker. And it will send a message to my tracker software saying, hey, we just saw your keys on the beach, no matter where I am. So pretty much anywhere you go, there's 1.5 million trackers. You're going to get feedback about where your stuff is. You will never lose it. We sent some to Johnny Jett, our travel guru. He put them in his bag. What a great idea. So now he knows where his luggage is. Your phone can track up to 10 of these at once, which is great. It's Bluetooth LE, so the battery, it's a battery. You don't have to throw it out when it dies. You can replace it. It's just one of those little lithium coin-sized batteries. Now Tracker has this custom image printing, so you can personalize it with a printed image of your pet or your favorite podcast host. And then they have this new thing called the Tracker Atlas, which is awesome. You know, the tracker will say it's in your house because it's GPS, but the Tracker Atlas lets you pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your house. So now you know it's in your house. It's in the cushions of the sofa in front of the TV. You're going to never lose a thing again with a tracker. And right now we get you 30% off when you go to thetracker, thetracker.com, and use the promo code TRIANGULATION. That way they'll know you saw it on Triangulation, and you'll get 30% off on your entire order. So get them all. Get them all. Buy four, get six free, or whatever that is. The Tracker, TheTracker.com. Don't forget the promo code is Triangulation. David Heinemeier Hansen, DHH, is our esteemed guest. I love talking to programmers. I'm not a professional programmer. I'm a hobbyist. And I love languages, and I collect languages. And the first time I went through the Ruby on Rails tutorial, it might have been Ruby for Zombies. I can't remember which one I did first. I was like, because what happens is you type a command, it builds the scaffolding, and you've got a running application. You fire up your browser, there's your application running. And so much of it is done for you. I want to go back to the beginning. You said you didn't start programming. Was it in college that you started writing software?
It was sort of in between. I finished high school and took 3 years off to work in the internet business.
This is in Denmark.
This was in Denmark, yeah. Denmark had enough of the influences from the U.S. that we had our own little version of the dot-com boom and bust. And I worked at an incubator, at a portal, at all those good words you remember from the late 90s. And, of course, it all went belly up eventually. But
what did you do there? Were you in business?
I worked in content, actually. I got started with the whole internet thing because I wanted to run a gaming website. So I ran a couple of gaming websites for console games and computer games, reviews and discussions and all that stuff, community sites. And then this portal, it was a Danish or Scandinavian ISP called Get2Net. They had someone building this portal for them, and they wanted to have like a gaming section on their site. So they ended up getting in touch with me and saying, hey, do you want a job? And I went like, oh, wow. Yeah, great. You can get paid to do this stuff. That sounds interesting. And I did that for a while. And then that's how I sort of got more and more into the whole internet thing, the whole internet business thing. And this was still before, this was late 99, late, yeah, 98, 99, 2000. At most, my programming skills in the beginning were like HTML. And then I started dabbling. I started dabbling with ASP, Microsoft's thing.
Oh, wow.
Back then, I started dabbling with PHP. Just started reading up on a bunch of software development methodology.
No wonder you liked Ruby so much.
Seriously, I got exposed to sort of the rough end. although, I mean, that's not entirely fair. I really enjoyed PHP for the same reasons you just said what was interesting about Ruby, right? That you typed a command and boom, you could go to the browser and you could see something.
Yeah.
That experience PHP gave me. Like, you could write a PHP page, you could upload it with FTP, and like you typed in hello world or a few commands and boom, you saw something live on the screen. There was nothing to set up. In some ways, that experience is still better than what we have in the Ruby world today. In part because it's optimized for something else. I mean, we optimize Ruby on Rails for sort of these long-running applications like Basecamp and so forth. And PHP was just, at that time, really uniquely well-optimized for, like, just one page. I just need one page, which is a great way to get started. That was always what scared me off in the beginning from these other environments, was it just took so much work to get going. And to even do that work, there wasn't any scaffold commands. You had to read all these books, and you had to dive in through all this stuff, and you had to do all these XML configurations, and all just to say hello world. That just felt like utterly frustrating and a complete waste of time. So I got started because things were easy in languages that were easy, even if those languages perhaps then at some point run out of steam in terms of their sweet spot. For the things that I wanted to do. But I really credit PHP and the immediacy that that had for allowing me to make the jump from HTML and CSS and sort of that declarative presentation into making something that was dynamic and start working. And then by early 2001, I helped build a gaming site that actually still is around today, dailyrush.dk.
Oh, yeah.
Which was all built in PHP, and I wrote a fair amount of that just by cobbling things together and working with other programmers who actually didn't know what they were doing, right? So I learned a bunch from them. And then it was kind of through that that I then I landed another job working actually for the founder of Zendesk. He had a company in Copenhagen called Kput that was making a community platform built on Java and J2E. And they hired me to do front-end stuff like HTML and JavaScript and so on. And it was so funny because I remember I didn't think of myself as a programmer, right? Like I knew some HTML, I knew some JavaScript, I dabbled a bit with PHP. And then here I was applying for this job where one of the job requirements was you had to know JSP, Java server-side pages. And I was like, yeah, I hope I can pick that up. It was kind of like a gamble. So when they wrote me back, like, oh, yeah, please come for an interview, I was like scrambling to find the O'Reilly animal book on JSP pages and like cram it over the weekend such that I could show up on Monday for that interview and sound like I actually had a clue of what I was talking about.
I think one of the reasons people like DHH so much is because we all can completely identify with that story. And you're very identifiable, which is awesome. Sometimes that we look at people like Guido and Larry and Matt's kind of up there. But you, and this is not a knock, but you're one of us, you know, and I think people really, really like you for that reason, you know?
Yeah, there's no magic here. Like, no, super child prodigy smarts, to get going. I think the thing with sharing though is most people are relatable if they just dare to be honest.
Yes.
And most people just don't dare to be honest.
I agree.
Because that's scary for all sorts of reasons. And that's how they end up not being relatable because they don't tell the stories about how they were.
Right. We're all human.
Not knowledgeable or stupid or took a gamble or whatever, right?
We all do the same dumb stuff.
Right. It's just, I think the difference is in whether you choose to share it.
Absolutely. And that's what makes people, you know, when they say somebody's authentic, all that means is they're telling the truth about themselves instead of pretending to be something special, a special little flower. I think what you're talking about is interesting because sometimes they talk about languages as being fashionable and going in and out of fashion. But I think it's really more that languages are often of their times. PHP, like BASIC before it, like Perl, was perfect for its time, wasn't it?
Yes, I think that's absolutely apt. That not only was it perfect for its time, I think that there's still a role for that. It's just creeps in.
Yeah.
So PHP today is very, very far removed from the sweet spot that was so instrumental in getting me into programming back in the late 90s, right? Like now they've gone whole hog and chased the same things as everyone else was chasing with big frameworks and...
Right.
All the stuff, typing and so forth. And I find that a shame because what I find to be so interesting with programming languages is the diversity. It's not that we all end up in the same place because that's really boring. I think that's why it's so interesting now with the rise of functional languages that they present something else. They have a different world view. They want to do things in a different way. Like that doesn't, for the most part, appeal to my core set of aesthetics, beliefs, or problems, but I love that it's something different. It's not just the same thing, right? And we already have plenty of things that do the same things. Like, as I keep sort of thinking about, like, why did Ruby on Rails stick around? Like, most things don't get to run for, what have we been around, 13 years now?
Wow,
Most people don't get to have a trajectory like that and still have some relevance at the end, right? And I think part of it is just that the time is still there. The kind of applications that brought Ruby on Rails onto the scene are still the kind of applications that a lot of people are writing and want to be writing. So it's still relevant.
Yeah.
But I always think about like there's when that time comes, when it's something else, when we truly do move to a different platform, if the internet stopped being the thing where we send HTML and JavaScript and so forth back and forth, then I will let Ruby on Rails gracefully go into the night. Because I hate it. I hate when I see things that were just so perfect for their niche and for their optimization, then go chasing, oh, well, now people don't want that thing anymore. Let's turn it into something else.
Yeah.
No, let it be the thing that it is and be beautiful for that. And it had its time. If Ruby on Rails' time ended up being, let's say, 2 years from now, like something comes out and it's completely irrelevant, it had 15 beautiful years in the sun. Like, That's more than you can ask of almost any piece of technology, right? And let it go beautifully into the night as well. I feel the same thing about technology at large. People are freaking out over the fact that Apple might drop the 3.5 millimeter jack from the next iPhone, right? And I go like, really? Like, that's the thing we're going to be nostalgic about? We're going to be nostalgic about connectors? Like, who's nostalgic about the CD drive? Like, I haven't had a CD drive in a computer I've owned for at least 5 years, right? Maybe longer than that. Just go like, that's just not the thing I want to be nostalgic about. But, hey, to each their own.
It would be different if we didn't all have thousands of headphones with many jacks on them.
That was always true, right? We all had thousands of CDs. We all had thousands of movies. We all had thousands of discs, of floppy disks, and there's always that time, right? There's never the legacy doesn't go away, but still we move to the future. And which future is it not better, for example, with wireless headphones? I just got a QB35, I think they're called, Bose noise canceling headphones, and they're wireless, and I'm like, it's like sitting in a Tesla for that first time. Once you don't have wires on your freaking headphones, you go like, why did we wait so long? Why did civilization wait so long? The amount of man and women years spent untangling headphones in their pockets that got all tangled up. I mean, the drain on world productivity could probably have paid for a Hoover dam a few times over. And then you put on those things and you go like, yeah, this is right. Like, that's how it's supposed to be. That's how music is supposed to enter your head. Not that you spend 5 minutes untangling your headphones in your pocket.
You got a good point,
Tesla,
actually.
Right? You get into Tesla and you sit down and like all the familiar noises are gone. And like, as we talked about, it's a digital on-on switch with the acceleration. You go like, oh yeah, of course this is the future.
It's weird. You don't even turn it on or off.
Exactly.
You just get in the car and go.
I love the future that just cuts out things that we used to do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, then they kind of complicate our lives in all sorts of other new and interesting novel ways, at least. But
that keeps us interested.
We're not untangling our headphones from our pockets anymore. We'll be wondering why the Bluetooth won't connect, perhaps, or other things like that. But hey, new problems.
I think you've won me over. I'm going to have to go out and get some QC35 headphones. So let me ask you about Rails. Were you familiar with Rails? Was the first framework that I ever became aware of. Were you familiar with frameworks before you started working on it?
Yeah, I owe some of that to Mikkel and the guys now at Zendesk that worked at KPUT back in the day. That's when I really got introduced to framework with a capital F, because they were doing all their stuff in J2E. So Java, I give it a lot of crap, and I think deservedly so. But one thing that it really did bring to the table, I think, was this whole framework mentality, in part because the language itself was just so lacking in expressiveness that if you did not have frameworks, it would be considered cruel and unusual punishment for anyone to work in. Not only did you need frameworks, you need tooling of all sorts to make it just halfway bearable. But in any case, that discovered a bunch of, I discovered through Java, a bunch of really good ideas about frameworks, how they should be to be put together and so on. And what I saw, it was sort of like, You spot something in the dirt and you go like, there's something shiny there. I can't really see what it is because there's all this dirt covering it. But if you blow the dirt off, you see like, oh, wow, there's a beautiful diamond here of an idea. And all those ideas of the frameworks, I thought, these are amazing. This is amazing ideas. Like, I've been doing PHP, which was all about the hand-rolled. Everyone do their own free-for-all kind of thing. And you just get a database adapter and then off you go. Make everything happen yourself. And then I get into Java and I see all these elaborate frameworks and I go like, wow, that would be amazing if these weren't written in Java. And that was a big part of the motivation, that I wanted to basically take these ideas that I had been so inspired by in Java and say like, hey, let's liberate them from the shackles of a language that's just a depressing place to work.
You were influenced by Kent Beck and design patterns and things like that too, right?
Usually so. Kent and Martin Fowler and Ward Cunningham and all those guys. I sort of got into those streams at the same time, both the framework and the engineering sense of it from the Java world. But then what also was happening in Java was it was sort of, that was the economic center of programming world, right? Like this was where all businesses were investing all their stuff. So this was where all the consultants were going. And lots of consultants have really good ideas about how to do things. And Kent and Martin and Ward Cunningham and a bunch of other people, that's where they were applying their ideas. So when you were reading about methodologies and approaches, it was easy to get introduced to that when you were in the Java world. I remember the first real conference I went to was JAO, J-A-O-O, in Denmark in 2003. And I got to see Kent Beck on stage. I got to meet Martin Fowler, Dave Thomas, Ward Cunningham, and Matt, actually. Oh, there you go.
2003. Look at that.
2003. So I got to see, I got so many influences from these companies. It's funny because since then, I don't know, my view of, I don't necessarily enjoy conferences that much anymore. But that one conference, I really do credit with just starting so much good stuff. I remember seeing Kent Beck on the stage talking about extreme programming and going like, that's amazing. Like Kent really devised an entire methodology or at least composed it and presented it in a way where it just blew my mind. The clarity of which he had distilled the concepts and could sell them in a very approachable way where you just went, yeah, oh yeah, I totally see all these problems you're talking about and I want whatever it is that you're selling. Oh, is it TDD? Oh, great. Like, let me get some of that. Let me get going with that. Is it extreme programming? Excellent. Refactoring? Yes. Let's get going. And Kent is just an amazing presenter of ideas and originator of ideas too. But what I got there was the presentation of him and it was just fantastic. This was also the conference where I walked up to Dave Thomas and started arguing with him about DRM on books because
Right on. Yeah.
I bought some books, I think maybe from O'Reilly or somewhere else. And I was like, this is such a hassle. If I just had a PDF, I could search it. I could have it next to my thing and so on. And I had a long conversation with Dave Thomas about, I don't think people are actually going to pirate as much as you think they're going to do. And I hope that that at least helped things a little bit. That he said, like, all right, we'll try it on something. We'll see how it goes. And I think that turned out pretty well. Today, DRM is just not a thing for technical books, right? Not because of anything I did, but just at that time, it was the established wisdom that you needed DRM. Otherwise, like people would just pirate your stuff and nobody would buy it. And I think Dave Thomas and was a pioneer for that in getting books out. You just got a PDF. And not only could you just get a PDF, you could also get one updated. Like it was not a one version kind of thing because technology, especially if you're trying to describe something like a framework, it changes like every 5 minutes, right? So having more of a software mentality and a patch mentality to it worked out really well. And then, of course, I also met Matt. This was when I just started looking into Ruby. So I was just super excited to talk to Matt and about Ruby and Ward Cunningham. I had long conversation with Ward Cunningham about wikis because one of the first software projects I worked on was something called InSticky, which was a simple to set up wiki built in Ruby. And Ward, obviously, as the father of the wiki, just had tons of fascinating ideas. And I spent a long time talking to him. He had this concept of federated wikis, which he's still working on.
We had him on a couple of months ago, and yeah, he's still pushing it. And I set one up. It was interesting. I actually set up one of his wikis just to see. Yeah, and it's an interesting concept.
I love the idea of the wiki.
I do too.
I a lot love of time wikis. In wikis. Yeah. I haven't perhaps so much later because I found that the barrier of entry for someone to get it was surprisingly high. It's such a great simple idea.
It seems so obvious and simple.
It seems so obvious that this is a good thing, but it's very hard.
I agree. There's InSticky. Oh, no, that's his smallest wiki, yeah.
InSticky is still going, by the way. InSticky.org is still around.
Yeah.
With the original design as I left the project in, like, 2004. it's funny, though. I mean,
but wikis InSticky don't need design. That's not the point of a wiki. No,
absolutely. Couldn't agree more. It's just it's funny sometimes to see some of these things that I was involved with, and now you go, like, wait, what? That was 12 years ago?
Yeah.
How is that even, possible? But
when I first set up the radio show website, I did it in a wiki, and because I was hoping that listeners would participate, right? And of course, MediaWiki and Wikipedia are amazing golden example, one of the best things ever to happen. But for some reason, unless you get a, I don't know if it's the right community or a critical mass, and you're right, people just don't get it. So it made it an easy thing for me to maintain the website, but it didn't really get a community going up around it. It ended up just being filled with spam, so I had to turn it off. Spammers understand it.
Yes, very, very well. Hey, a page on the internet, we can just edit, and SEO is going to flow our way. It seems like the sign for us.
They got it.
That was funny. I mean, some of the features I spent the most time working on within Sticky was like version tracking and spam.
Rollback,
Rollback.
Yeah. Rollback is huge.
The Ruby on Rails, the original website, launched on InSticky. When it launched, it was an InSticky site. And actually, the way to submit patches, I think, was like to edit the wiki or something.
Oh, my God. You didn't have version control of any kind?
I had a wiki? Control, but it was running on my machine, I think, or something.
Of course.
And it was CBS, so it wasn't distributed.
Right. We've come a long way in that regard, too, haven't we?
Yeah. GitHub
is amazing. GitHub,
it definitely made things a lot easier.
Isn't GitHub in Ruby on Rails?
It is.
So? Yes.
There we go.
There you go. We're talking to DHH, the legend. I'm putting you right up there in the sky with Guido and Larry and Matt's the legend. And it's really great to talk to you.
It's a good thing that the color balance here is a little off. You can't see me blush.
Aw. You race cars. We'll talk a little bit about your cars and you're a Le Mans winning, Le Mans class winning race driver, which is pretty cool. A lot of programmers are musicians. Are you a musician too?
No.
Nope.
I tried to learn how to play the guitar a couple of years back and I was like, this is too hard.
Yeah, it's too hard. I agree.
It's too hard. It's going to take too long, much time.
Rails is easy. Guitar is
programming
hard.
Is easy to many extents. I actually think versus getting from not knowing guitar to actually being able to play a tune you'd be interested in listening to, it's hard.
Yeah. Well, that's where Rails is really amazing. So that is a problem with learning anything is you suck at first.
Yes.
And really the process of learning, whether it's a language, guitar, or programming, is getting over that hump, and then something clicks and you can do something. But Rails means you can actually do something instantly as your first program. The hello world for Ruby on Rails is a website. And that's awesome. I think that's part
really
of the power of it.
What got me motivated to do that whole spiel with the, because that was the hurdle that I kept hitting when I tried to learn programming and I failed, was I could never get to the I made something useful. And that was the thing that motivated me. If I couldn't get to something useful, then I was just doing toy examples. And I could spend my time doing other things than making toy programming examples. That's not what interests me or interested in me. So for Ruby on Rails, I really wanted that sensation that you could get to something. You didn't understand the whole thing. Of course, I mean, just because you type Rails generate, man, it's not like you understand.
It's kind of magic, yeah.
But it's so much easier to get the motivation to carry on and finally understand the whole thing if you actually see something real, right? Like that it's not just hello world.
Well,
because
and
that's
it starts
with the guitar, right? Like I would play the scale and I'd be like, that's not real. I don't want to listen to the scale.
Right.
Like I'm only doing the scale because I have to freaking learn how this thing is
and
I have to.
Yeah.
Mutilate my fingers to the point that they're all full of calluses and all that stuff, right? And then what? 3 months from now, I can play something that's interesting. I don't have the patience for this.
It's good you're impatient. But actually, it also generated this wonderful way of working where you create a minimum, what they call now, minimum viable product, and then you get input from your users, and then you modify it in real time while the program's running. And until people could do that, that was a breakthrough. But I want to talk more about that in a sec. We got to take a break. Do you cook?
Nope. But
nope.
I eat my wife's cooking, and I love the fact that she cares about it.
It's nice to have somebody in your
life. Of interest here. I'll set up the computers. And
yeah, that's good. You have to do that. You change the oil, take out the trash, wash the dishes.
Right.
She cooks.
Right. It's very 1950s in that sense.
It could flip, and that wouldn't be 1950s. But that's,
yes,
it's division of labor. That's what makes everything work. But I want to show you something. This is our sponsor for this segment, Blue Apron, that makes that their goal, their mission. They actually have a mission, is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody, while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. So if you have been, look, everybody's got to eat. Going to the fast food restaurant or the chain restaurant down the road to eat is not eating. That's not, you want to make something delicious. But I understand why everybody does that, because you're at the end of the day, you're tired. The last thing you want to do is do a meal plan, menu plan, and go shopping, get the ingredients, you get home, cook. This is the solution, Blue Apron. When you get home, Blue Apron Day, and you set the day, and that Blue Apron box, it's refrigerated. It has fresh ingredients. Even the meats and fish are fresh. Produce from local farms, 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. And exactly the ingredients you need. No more, no less. If you need one clove of garlic, there's one clove of garlic in there. So there's never any waste. And then it's got a recipe card. And you make this amazing meal, and you could do it in 40 minutes or less. It's less expensive, about 60% less. Grocery stores cost more because they have a building and blah, blah, blah. Direct to consumer, grocery stores are 60% more expensive than Blue Apron. So you're going to save money. It's less than 10 bucks a meal. You're going to make delicious, healthy meals. And without even knowing it, you're going to learn. And the next time you want to cook a meal, you'll say, oh, you know what? We should do those spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad again. That was really good. Or the summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplants, shishito peppers, and corn. Or how about chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa? Look at this. Spicy chicken and Korean rice cakes. Look, you can make this. The other thing that happens is the house fills with this beautiful aroma. It's an aesthetic experience. They have plans for couples. They also have plans for families. Blue Apron families cook nearly three times together more often. There's the chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. Doesn't that look great? I got a deal for you. You got to try it. We're going to get you three meals free so you get a sense of what this is. BlueApron.com/twit. Three meals free. BlueApron.com/twit. You can cook. You will love it. You get to pick the menus. You know, you can go to the website, say, I want this, not that. They have vegetarian, they have, you know, whatever you need. You pick the day your Blue Apron box comes, the first time, you're going to be so excited. BlueApron.com/twit. Three meals free. And we thank them for their support of Triangulation. DHH is our guest. He is the creator of Ruby on Rails. He's a legend. Founder of Basecamp with Jason Fried. You actually, I love the story. Jason was having trouble with a PHP programming, and you said, hey, I can help. And that's how you guys met, which is awesome. But you had studied business, right? You were at business. We went to business school.
I went to business school just as I started working with Jason, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
I did a three-year program at the Copenhagen Business School.
So were you interested in business too? Was that, or was that just
because
you were?
I'm always interested in business. I sort of earned my own money from a pretty young age, newspapers, working at a grocery store. And then once I think I got about, what was I, like maybe 13, I started selling pirated CDs for software. And I ran my own bulletin board.
Did you tell Dave Thomas that?
I don't know if I forgot to. I included it now because the statute of limitation on being prosecuted.
You know what? We all have to start somewhere. Jobs and Woz started with blue boxes. You all have to start somewhere.
Right. I mean, did that too. Calling cards, international calling cards.
Nice.
Figuring out how to hack MCI's algorithm for generating new cards.
Wow.
Hack was a pretty big word. I think it was like the 16th and the 17th digit. You could go up one and down on the other, and then you got a new card. Like, that was how sophisticated
that's really a good system.
The system was, right? So I always interested in business, always interested in the whole process of that, and not the least convincing people to buy something that they didn't need, think they needed. So the sort of basics of marketing,
sales.
Yeah. And not in sort of the, like, I want to sell you something that you don't want, but as in a reflection of my own experience that I stumble across lots of products that I didn't think I needed. I didn't think I needed a range finder or Leica camera until like I had successful enough
once you
marketing
get one.
And advertising to let me have a look at that. And then I tried it and I went like, I wish I would have found this 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. It's not always selling you something you don't want or don't need. It's just that you don't know you want it yet.
Yes. And I think that's a very noble definition of marketing, a very noble definition of sales. And it often gets cast in this aspirational or not even aspirational, in a negative sense. Of
right.
It, right.
That, like, oh, it's persuasion. Like,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Manipulation.
We don't want, really yeah. don't want. They're making us buy things we really shouldn't have. Right. And like, says who?
Yeah, that's a good point.
A number of things that I've bought because marketing has worked. I mean, it's substantial. We don't discover everything from first principle, and we don't just discover everything by accident. And there's no inherent glory in that, I think. There's no shame in being excited about a product because the company is really good at talking about that product. I think, isn't that the world working? That we share ideas and we share solutions, and then we use the beauty of a market to exchange those things? That's how we all level up.
We're all in, somebody once told me we're all in sales. If you're not, it's not necessarily a product, you're selling yourself.
Your ideas and your experiences and so forth. I've been in sales for as long as I can remember in that sense. It's the same thing when I started with reviews. I was basically selling video games, the ones I liked, because I wrote up a really good review about them. And the purpose was to persuade the reader to think, oh, this is a really great game. I should have this game. And I got there through review, right? So perhaps that's a more noble sense that I supposedly didn't have an agenda, where salespeople, obviously, they have an agenda of trying to sell their product, not just any product in general. But I also find lots of people actually do believe in the products that they sell. Like, I certainly believe in my product. I try to be a salesperson for Basecamp whenever I have the opportunity, because I truly believe that if I can get someone to use Basecamp who I think might benefit from it, like, their life is actually going to be better. Like, they're not going to go back to me after and say, oh, you sold me this Basecamp and, like, I didn't really want it, but then I ended up paying for it for 5 years. Like, that's not how the story goes, right? Like, either they give it a try, they give Basecamp a try, and they find out, okay, they don't want it, they don't like it, or whatever, then they quit. Or I actually did sell them in a positive way. They ended up liking it, and it did change their life for the better, or the business for the better. And in 5 years, if they're still around, presumably they're going to thank me for, well, or at least feel like it was a worthwhile trade, right? Because otherwise, presumably, they would have not used the product. So I find that to be a noble activity and something that I take great pride in doing. The same thing with Ruby on Rails. The amount of salesmanship that I apply to Ruby on Rails, I think, is one of those things that got it off the ground. And at the time when it was being applied, it was unheard of.
Yeah, you don't pitch a programming framework.
Exactly. People were not pitching, especially open source. Like, the only people who were pitching programming languages and tools, like, they were the big corporations, Microsoft and Sun, right?
Yeah.
And IBM, perhaps.
Yeah.
They were pitching things because they had those big, nasty marketing departments and so on. Programmers just had an inherent distrust of all that. And here I come in and say, like, hey, I'm going to goddamn sell this thing as you've never been sold before, because I think this is a wonderful leap forward. It was for me, like, I went from literally thinking, I don't want to be a programmer, to discovering Ruby and thinking, wow, programming is one of the most fun things that I can do with my time, even if I had all the options in the world. I got to sell other people on this, because there's a lot of people who would really benefit from that. So I sold it really, really hard. That was all the stuff with the first 15-minute video, which at the time people were not doing that. And I put a very excited video out that was actually a recording from a presentation, one of the first presentations of Ruby on Rails I did in Brazil, and I was too lazy to redo it again. So I just took the audio from that recording in Brazil, and then I was typing as the audio was playing to follow along to make my video. But anyway, I mean, I was selling it really hard. And I think some people absolutely took offense to that. They went like, hey, wait a minute. There you go. There's the video. They went like, hey, wait a minute, what is this? Like, I don't want to be sold. Like, this is supposed to be objective truths, that either this is the right tool for the job or it's not the right tool for the job. Well, I hate that saying. I think that's complete bullshit. The right tool for the job is such a cop-out. It's such a misreading of human beings as irrational, passionate people. There's never a right tool for the job, ever. There is the tool that meets your passions and interests and aesthetics and the way you like to be sold at the right time. And that's about it. So that I drove that through as well as hard as I could, thinking basically like everyone making information systems for the web today potentially could be using Ruby on Rails. And I find it a fun challenge to try to persuade them to at least give it a try. So
it's not exactly, you know, selling Ginsu knives. I mean, let's watch a little bit. This is David's first video. It's now on YouTube from the Fizzle conference in 2005. I remember watching this probably around then, and you sold me. We won't watch the whole 15 minutes. Watch. Listen to. Do we have audio on it?
Here we go. So I hope you can read the text. The first thing we do is called the Rails command to generate the skeleton of the application. So you saw it generated a bunch of things, a bunch of files, and then the next step, the very next step, is starting the Ruby server. So seeing that everything works. The only prerequisite to this is that you have Ruby on Rails installed. Whoops.
There it is. Whoops, it worked. This is an hard sell. I mean, this is pretty impressive. And when I first saw it, I didn't think, oh, I'm being sold on something. I was like in awe. You did that whole framing,
right? Like the best selling is you don't know you're being sold. The best selling is just that the thing itself seems so appealing. But I guarantee you, you could have presented Ruby on Rails in the traditional objective state manner. And now I'm going to blah, blah, blah. And it wouldn't have, then that at least aspect of it wouldn't have worked, right? Like no one would have gone like, oh, geez, I got to try this. Because also, I mean, even just the title, 15 minutes to build a blog. I mean, let's be fair here. That's salesmanship. Yeah. Like it was a true blog. You wouldn't truly launch it. Like there was a lot of things that weren't done. It was like a home cooking show where like, oh, and I've already prepared here and like the events, right? Like, so let's see the whole thing in 5 minutes that actually takes perhaps 2 hours to do. But in any case, I did strongly believe in the product. I did believe that there was a quantum leap here, an order of magnitude improvement in what I had experienced before. And I wanted other people to have a chance at sampling that. And I knew that programmers, and perhaps because I knew myself, are very loath to step out of their comfort zone.
Right. I already know this. I have a great tool.
Love to learn new programmer languages, right? Like, oh, I learned 5 new programmers last year.
And I get nothing done because of it.
right. But that's the hobby itself. And then I'd say, then there's the other 80 or 90 or maybe 95% who just like, well, I learned Java or I learned PHP. It's working well enough. I'm not going to rock that boat. Like now I have paid work and contracts and
packages
and all this stuff.
That's why so many people still write Java.
Yes, I think, right, in part. So I knew that you needed a jolt to the system. It was not enough to have like a tab. You needed like 10,000 volts. Like, I'm going to give you 10,000 volts right now to get your attention that a tab on the shoulder would never have gotten your attention. And I think that that was what most or a lot of open source software at the time was being promoted with was a tap on the shoulder. Hey, if you happen to be in this situation where you need this thing, maybe you should consider. Mm-hmm. And I just went, no. That's going to be too slow. I'm too impatient for that. Let's go a little faster. Let's turn up the voltage 10,000.
And I think people have learned from that. You see strong evangelism now for a lot of open source projects. Absolutely. And I think evangelism maybe is another way of saying sales. But you see it. But you're not, I mean, it was free. It's not like you said, give me money for Ruby on Rails. You're giving it away. So.
Yeah, because, I mean, what I was selling was an idea. And I think that just for me felt like I actually owed the open source community to do this.
Nice.
To get to this point, I needed to use Ruby. I needed to use Apache. I needed to use MySQL. I needed to use so much open source software that was all free to me. Like if I had to either buy an Oracle database license or figure out how to write a database myself, like I would never have done any of the things that I did.
Yeah.
So I felt by the time I had crystallized Ruby on Rails enough to feel like there's something here, I felt this is my obligation. I am a jackass if I do not share my toys when I've benefited so greatly from all these other toys that were just left out for me to enjoy.
Do you remember showing it to Mats for the first time?
I don't remember. I don't think I actually ever ended up showing him in person because I met him in 2003 and I had only just started on Ruby then. I had worked on InSticky a little bit. Maybe I showed him InSticky.
Uh-huh.
But Thankfully, then things turned out in such a way that Matt's, I'm sure, got plenty of chance to to see in Rails and that such. And it has worked as a great harmony, I think. In many ways, though, as a sort of more of a remote distance relationship, in the sense that, like, so not like I've talked to Matt maybe a handful of times total.
Interesting. That's funny.
Literally on one hand.
Yeah.
And yet we can collaborate on this majestic thing, yeah. Ruby on Rails, right? Yeah. Like the both things are moving forward and they continue to have improvements. And all that can happen, all that coordination can happen without us having to like get into a conference room. And okay, now we have to really hash out these big ideas, which is why perhaps also in part, I've always been such a big fan of remote work and why I've just been laughing my ass off when I hear these justifications for why we're going to stop the remote working at Yahoo because to have creativity in the office and to really get everyone on the same ship, we all need to eat lunch together. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And I just go like, hey, wait. Listen to yourself for a minute. Do you use open source software? Have you used any of these systems? How complex do you think it is to build, say, Ruby or even Rails these days? Rails have had, I think, 6,000 people contribute to over the years. Ruby, I'm sure, hundreds as well, or thousands maybe even. Lots and lots and lots of huge systems that are basically running the goddamn internet are built this way by remote people collaborating asynchronously. And you don't think that's good enough for your little shop here? Yeah, okay.
In my mind, it's why open source is going to win. I think we're going to see the end of proprietary operating systems, databases, even user land applications, and open source. It's winning, isn't it? I mean, it really is winning.
It's winning the infrastructure. I'm not so sure.
Not the desktop yet.
I'm not so sure there even is a win to be had on the user side. I think that's much, much harder.
Well, what about Android?
Well, I mean, let's be fair. That's Google. A very proprietary system pouring in a lot of things. And then, I mean, the reasons, if they could undo that decision today, I'm quite sure they would. I don't think actually Google has gotten anything good out of open sourcing Android. And also, they're totally retreating, right? Like, if you want to build an Android phone, yeah, technically you can build it, and lots of Chinese manufacturers do, build it on Android alone. But if you don't have the Google services and you don't have the Google Play and all that stuff, then it's kind of a pretty crippled version of Android. It's certainly not the version of Android that they're selling on stage at Google I.O., right? The Google I.O. sales pitch is for the version of Android that Google controls.
You probably could say the same thing for Macintosh and Darwin. And
Exactly.
Yeah.
For infrastructure plumbing, open source has totally won, right? Dominatingly so. But on the user side, I don't think there is a win. Because the kinds of, at least so far, I guess perhaps I shouldn't be so pessimistic, but at least so far, the kind of people and the kind of coordination that open source have fostered and attracted has really been about like building up a shared commons. Because like, oh, I'm going to build this for you because I also need it too, and then we can share our solution. That kind of way of working, I don't think works as well as for coming up with like a slick UI for an end user application.
I have to say, though, since the Windows 10 debacle, the kind of forced marketing of Windows 10, I've started putting Arch Linux on all of my desktop computers. And my experience of desktop Linux has gotten, I think they've come so far that it is a very appealing operating system. It works quite well.
Who do we have to thank for that? The web.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It works so well because, like, browsers work well on multiple.
Yeah,
systems.
Yeah. I admit, I put Chromium on top of it, and that's pretty much all I'm living in, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. You're right.
Like, so you turn it into an internet appliance portal.
That's what it
and,
is.
And like that works well.
Yeah.
But if you actually want to run any local software, I mean, the good thing is obviously, as Google has demonstrated very well too, that most people don't need to run local software.
Right.
Most people can actually get away
with
just running.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, a browser is what most people prefer to have.
Right.
With some exceptions, but, yeah.
I want to talk about racing. Let's take a break. I want to hear about the Zonda. the Monterey Blue. Wait a minute, I have it here somewhere. This is a beautiful car. There it is. You still have those?
I do. They're very cherished. Of the few things that I've been able to do with the sort of the economic success that's come out of running a business, those two things are high on that list.
They are works of art.
Absolutely.
David Heinemeier Hansen is our guest, DHS. We'll have more. DHS is the Department of Homeland Security, another thing entirely. We'll have more in a moment. Our show today brought to you by Texture, the mobile app that lets you get basically binge read all the magazines in the world, practically, all the big ones. You know, we've gotten used to the idea with Netflix that you pay one flat rate and you can look at all these. This is the same idea for magazines, binge reading instead of binge watching. And boy, the greatest magazines. And I have to say, I think there's great stuff being done in magazines, but who wants to go to the newsstand and buy one at $6? You know, you can't. That, and then you get the coffee table problem where you get all this junk on your coffee table. Subscribing is even worse. And yet I would say every month there's something in Wired magazine I want to read. There's something in Rolling Stone I want to read. I want to see some photo essays in the National Geographic, Sports Illustrated, People Magazine. You get them all at texture.com/straight. You could try it free right now. Over 200 of the world's best magazines. The New Yorker for cooking, Bon Appetit, Consumer Reports, Vogue. And I have to say, they're magazines I probably would never buy or subscribe to, but I love seeing, like Billboard. I love to know what's on the hot 100 Billboard charts. Well, I'm not going to go buy Billboard or subscribe to Billboard just for that, but it's in there so I can do that. I love Texture. One of the best parts of it is you can have a family subscription. You can access 5 devices on a single account. So my wife and I both have one subscription. We have our own subscription magazines that we favorite. You can read them offline. And it's every page in the newsstand edition, plus back issues, plus bonus features that you cannot get, like video, in a print magazine. Texture is amazing. They've completely reimagined the magazine reading experiences. And by the way, I think this is the thing that's going to save a magazine. Some of the best writing being done right now is being done for monthly and weekly publications. And this is the best way to get it on your iPhone, on your Android device, on your tablet. Go to texture.com/twit and sign up for that free trial. Texture, TEXTURE.com/twit. Isn't summertime the time you read more magazines, right? You take them to the beach and stuff. Just take your iPad and you got them all. 200 plus great magazines. Texture.com/twit. The legendary David Heinemeier Hansen, DHH, is our guest on Triangulation today. What fun to talk to him. And he is, among other things, likes cars. And you race them. You don't just have them in your driveway. Do you still race?
It's great that they're works of art, but I really enjoyed the driving. And absolutely do I race. I was just came back last week from Germany. I compete in something called the World Endurance Championship, which includes that oh-so-famous race of the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And this season, I'm racing with Porsche.
You are? So, nice.
Absolutely. I love it. Of all the hobbies that I have outside of computers, this is probably one of my most cherished ones.
That is awesome. And I was asking, because I know you're staying in Malibu for the summer, if you've raced down the Pacific Coast Highway, but I think you can't.
No. It's funny that driving on a racetrack really cures you in many ways of wanting to drive fast on the street.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're just not comparable at all. Once you've tried to really fly into a corner on a racetrack at 10 tenths at 140 miles an hour, and you have to break down to 70 in just a few seconds, then whatever you can do in the street in terms of driving fast, it just pales. Yeah. So what I enjoy instead is just driving the street, especially out here in California, which is beautiful, right?
Yeah.
Like you can drive around 45 miles an hour and it's still an amazing ride.
You're right.
There's just something about controlling a steering wheel, being out in the open. That's why I love convertibles.
Right.
Just the elements and being in it. It's just such a bliss.
I think it's important to have a hobby that is kind of diametrically opposed to what you do day in, day out. And driving's perfect because you're sitting in a fixed location typing, you know, at kind of a fixed focal length, and it's very cerebral. And then you get to this kind of very visceral where motion is everything. And it's a whole different kind of experience. I think it uses a different part of your brain. I think that's very smart. And do you still do photography?
I do. Lately, family photography has been the thing that's really caught my attention. I have two boys now, and
how old
they're
are
always
their
subjects. They're 3.5 and 6 months old. So
wow,
just there's always something for. Yep, there you go. There's
your flicker
up in the upper right.
Yeah.
So it's just, I really just enjoy taking pictures of them because it's just so much fun to see them develop and grow, and also just to remember. Like I try to remember now, oh, what did Colt actually look like when he was 6 months old? And you go back, oh, this is exactly why. Right. And it was funny. I've had sort of ups and downs in photography of
these
focusing
are beautiful. Wow.
Sometimes on doing it and then sometimes not. And that was why I mentioned Leica earlier. That was really what got me back in. Leica is kind of like my ruby of photography. Because Leica packs the full punch of the best image quality in the world on par with any camera from Canon or Nikon or whatever. But those are huge honking machines. And I used to have those huge honking machines. And then I just went like, it's too much of a hassle. Let me just take my iPhone. And then I took my iPhone for quite a while. And I looked at those pictures and I went, that's not how I remember that memory. That looks crap. Sorry. Like the iPhone is a great sort of leap forward for a lot of photography just in terms of accessibility. But if you compare a photo made with a proper camera like a Leica to something from an iPhone, it's just night and day. And I just went like, I want those memories. I want the captures of my kids that I can look at 20 years from now to be in better quality than an iPhone.
These are gorgeous. Which Leica are you shooting with?
It's called the Leica M. Right now, the model number is 240. They made a bunch of different ones, but it's a rangefinder. So that's the reason why it can be so tiny, in part, because the lenses are manual focus. So there's no autofocus. You have to align two ghost images on top of each other. It's a very odd thing. Like when it was first described to me, I went like, wait, what? Two ghost images on top of each other? What does that even mean? But that's how this rangefinder system works. That's how you set the focus length. And it makes the camera tiny. Like this is a really small camera. You can put it in a bag. You can just hang it over your shoulder and not get a bad shoulder from it. Unlike those big honking DSLR cameras from Canon and Nikon and so forth. So I really fell in love with that. And I just started very quickly to produce a level of pictures that I just went, wow, this just looks amazing. I've never taken pictures like this. I've never taken pictures that look this good. That's the hallmark of a true product or an amazing product, that it makes you feel like you're a superstar. It's less so about the Leica. It's more about, oh, I kind of feel like I'm a photographer now. Like I take good pictures that I'm really proud of and I love looking back on. And when we sent them to family and whoever else are not around all the time to see the boys grow up, they go like, wow, that's really cool. So just love that.
Love the images. That's wonderful. Yeah, there's something about that rangefinder. The first time I used one, it was like, this is way too hard.
It is.
It's really painstaking. And yet that's why you get great images, because you're really involved in the process, I think.
But you also learn it pretty quick. I actually started out when I first read about Leica. I read about Leica many years in advance of actually getting one, which is kind of like programming. I dabbled in it many years in advance of actually going with it, but then I rented one. There's something called lensrentals.com, which is great because those Leica are horrendously expensive. So I didn't want to buy one and then find out that I couldn't adjust to the rangefinder. So I rented one from lensrentals.com, and I got it, and like it took a weekend. It's kind of like that, again, the Ruby thing. Like over a weekend, I just went like, oh, wow, this is what I've been waiting for. This is what I want to do when I take photos. So then I ended up buying one after trying it and haven't regretted since. And probably of all the purchases I've made in the last 3 years, that is my favorite.
Yeah, I have all the 5D and all that stuff, and I end up buying a Leica Q, which is about half as much as the M, but I use it all the time. It's the camera.
I have
camera.
A Q as well. Amazing camera.
I love that camera. And it's so compact, and you just throw it around and...
Right.
You know, that one is one lens, so there's not, you don't even have to bring lenses with you.
Right. A really great camera. I just happened to fall in love with the 50 millimeter focal length.
Yeah.
So for me, that necessitated. And now I've also fallen in love with the rangefinder itself. It's kind of like the manual transmission.
Yeah.
I remember before I learned how to drive a car, I went like, wait, cars exist where you don't actually have to change gears yourself.
why would you
get a car where you have to do that yourself? That seems like such nonsense, right? And then I, along with apparently lots of other people, kind of fell in love with that mechanical connection.
Right.
And rangefinder gives you a mechanical connection with photography that's just not possible with the digital setup.
Yeah.
There's other drawbacks to it, obviously. Try to capture a running kid with a rangefinder is a bit of a challenge because it's sort of like a very delicate process, and it's best if the subjects are standing still. So it's not exactly for sports photography, but fun challenge, and I just enjoyed it a bunch.
What a pleasure. Speaking of enjoyment, to talk to you, there's so much more we could talk about, but our time is up, and you've been very generous with your time. So thank you, David Heinemeier Hansen, DHH. Read the Signal versus Noise blog. It's on Medium, signalvnoise.com. David and Jason and the gang from Basecamp share there, and great stuff. And you've been writing a lot of stuff on Medium, too, and other venues. It's great. It's really fun to read your writing. Everybody should try Ruby on Rails if you haven't, especially if you're not a programmer. You might become one just overnight.
And, be careful.
Yeah, and I look forward to talking again with you. It's always a pleasure. Thank you, DHH.
Thank you so much for having me.